Trainer Talks and Tales acknowledges the traditional owners and custodians of the land in which we're recording this podcast, the Turrbal and Yugara people of Meanjin. We pay our respects to elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
Trainer Talks and Tales love having an array of guests with a variety of opinions. However, the views of the individuals do not necessarily reflect the perspectives of the host facilities. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Trainer Talks and Tales. You are, of course, joined by your two co-hosts. I am Daisy, and I am, of course, joined by the lovely Tess.
Hello, Daisy. How's it going?
I'm good, thank you. Excited for another episode. And I do appreciate that we say that every single time, but we just have such a good variety of guests that coming on. So we really hope that you enjoy this episode. But before we get into it, how's your week been, Tess? What have you been up to?
Yeah, really good. Thank you, Daisy. I have been quite social. So I've been trying to have a social day and then a day at home just to make sure that I'm not out and about all the time with a bubba, because driving a car with a screaming bubba is quite stressful at times. But I actually wanted to briefly talk about something that I have found as like a bit of a mum win this week. I am a terrible singer. I just want to, you know, put that out there first. But I found myself singing to Indie to go to sleep and during the day. And it worked every time because she just, you know, realized, oh, it's time to wind down, mum's singing kind of thing. And then I recorded it on my voice memos. And then I did a 9-minute rendition of it. So now when I want her to go to sleep, I put her in the bassinet and I put my phone there and my phone will sing to her and I can just go off and wash the dishes and do the things that I want to do.
And I love this so much.
That I'm still there singing to her. And I can hear myself singing on the other side of the house. And I come back, she's asleep, pick up my phone, and we're good to go. So that's been my little win this week and my hot tip for anyone with a baby.
That is the definition of work smarter and not harder. I love that. Joy.
Honestly.
That sounds so good.
Yeah. So I will never let you hear it, but you can use it as a tip, anyone at home. But yeah, that's about it for me. Just terrible singing and socializing here and there. What about you, Daisy? What's been happening in your world?
Yeah, well, I haven't been singing to any seals or anything this week, but I did go out to Stanthorpe for a couple of days with my husband, just for a couple of relaxing days. Everything in Stanthorpe is like so slow and so slow paced, and everyone's really present, we both found. So it was really nice to just like take some time to just be peaceful, not be on socials, and just kind of chill out, and hung out with a bunch of Highland cows, which are my favorite animals. So that was amazing. So exciting to do that. Work has been good. I've just started a new behavior with our sub-Antarctic fur seal, Nelson. We're doing a look back behavior. So the criteria is for him to touch his nose onto his rump. So he's going to bend all the way back to show the flexibility of seals and how flexible they are. So only a couple of training sessions in, first few approximations, it's just getting him touching the target, extending his neck. He's got a lot of history with the target pole for the backup behavior. So I also want to make sure that he's not moving when he's touching the target, so he stays still. So we've had a couple of successful approximations so far, but yeah, still super early days, but I'm excited to progress with that one a little bit too. And then I've just been super creative and having a lot of fun with my social media role at Sea Life. So I've seen a couple of listeners liking a couple of posts or following along. So thank you guys so much for supporting. It's a lot of fun to come up with some wild and wacky ideas. And the great thing is, as the social media creator, I'm always the one behind the camera. So it's never me that gets to be embarrassed in front of the camera. So shout out to my epic team and everyone I work with that is very willing to take on my crazy ideas. So yeah, that's it for me. But this week, we do have a really exciting guest, a little bit different topic compared to some of our other ones, but something that we took so much out of, both Tess and I. So we are lucky enough to be joined by Adam. He is in the Canine Correctional Unit for New South Wales, and he works really closely with dogs in the forces and to be able to utilize them for generally for odor detection. he goes through the different sort of training tools that they utilize, training conditions that they work, and how he's kind of been able to relate it back to zoos and aquariums, which is really cool. So I don't want to kind of take away too much because I feel like people are going to love listening to this episode. So I reckon we get straight into it. Adam, welcome to Trainer Talks and Tales. Tess and I are so excited to chat to you today.
Thank you for having me on, guys. Yeah, very honored to be asked to come speak on your podcast, and yeah, looking forward to this.
Yeah, we are so excited to dive into the topics we're discussing today because it's a bit of a new territory for Tess and I. So I'm sure everyone is excited to hear all about it. But we do start every single episode with our Fast Five. So before we get into any hard questions, are you happy if we start with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do it.
Okay, question number one, Macca's or Domino's?
A Macca's.
Question two, favorite species?
Dog.
Swimming or cycling?
Cycling.
Favorite color?
Purple, actually.
And ooh, finally, birds or reptiles?
Reptiles.
Now, can I just say that was a true Fast Five? Sometimes we have people that are just like, well, if you get me on a Monday or a Friday, it's yeah, a different answer. And I'm like, guys.
There was this one time in Costa Rica, I saw this, and you're like, no.
So no, you definitely got the memo, so it was great. Well, Adam, we'd love to start today by just kind of hearing a little bit more about your career background and how that's kind of led to what role that you're in now.
Yeah, so I guess where I could start is growing up as a child, I always wanted to work with dogs in some capacity. Growing up, I wanted to be a police dog handler. That was something I worked towards. Going through high school, I did the whole university, did my policing degree. Unfortunately, I have a colour vision deficiency, so that was not to be with New South Wales Police. So I sort of parked that ambition a little bit, continued on with university, seen what's out there, found out Corrective Services New South Wales has a canine unit. So then made it my mission to join them. So in 2015, I was fortunate enough to gain a position as a correctional officer with Corrective Services. And from there, I just sort of worked in various correctional centres around Sydney. I had a little bit of a diverse background. I started in a therapeutic sort of correctional centre, which focused on like drug rehab, and then obviously bounced around with our medium and maximum security jails. Now, my end goal was always to work in the canine unit. It was one of those jobs that was quite prestigious. You sort of served your time. Once you had your experience around the centres, you would sort of then have an opportunity to gain a position within the canine unit. It was actually at my, so 2019 specifically, I had made like got experience across multiple different centres. I was in a maximum centre and I'd started seeing working a bit more closely with the canine unit because they would come in and conduct searches and sort of operations. And then I was fortunate enough, one particular dog handler at that time, who later actually she became a little bit of a mentor to me once I joined the canine unit. I'll never forget this. She went upstairs, searched an area. She sent her dog off to conduct the search. I'll never forget. He was a little Kelpie. His name was Skip. He went into the middle of this area and like a little ballerina, he just started sniffing the air and started twirling around and then just landed in a sit position. And I didn't know what was happening at that stage because I obviously had no experience. And Katie, who was his handler, she just said to me, oh, just just go check the rear of that room. Sure enough, there was contraband hidden in a toilet roll. And she was excellent at reading her dog, but just how awesome it was to see the power of a dog's olfactory system. So it sort of was at that moment that I shifted from joining a canine unit was like a lifelong goal. When I saw that happen, I'm like, this is an obsession. Like, I want to know everything I can about detection dogs. Like, yeah, that was, I was already traveling that way to achieve that goal, but that was it. That solidified it. And then in 2020, I was incredibly fortunate enough to finally get to the canine unit myself. I completed my 14-week handler course. I was paired with my boy, who is a Kelpie Cross Dusty. He was 4 years old when I got him. He was rescued from the RSPCA. So he has quite a sort of a beautiful story behind his journey. He becomes like, he's like my best mate. He's with me every day. Yeah, I probably wouldn't be where I am if it wasn't for Dusty. So yeah, I owe a lot to him in sort of that journey to where I am now.
Wow. I mean, big shout out to Dusty. What a legend. But it's also amazing hearing your background, and so different to anything we've ever had on the podcast before. But I absolutely love how it ends. And like you said, it ends with an obsession with training. Like, it is an obsession. It's something that you just want to learn. There's like so much room to keep learning and growing and developing, things changing all the time. And I just think it's so special how, you know, your background has been working in maximum security areas, which is so different, like I mentioned, but we've ended in the same kind of goal, just in a different area. And I love the power of training and operant conditioning that we can do that across so many different roles.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
Before you touch further on this, I was just intrigued that you mentioned two species that, or two breeds that were Kelpies. Are there specific breeds that work better? Or, like, I'm a big Kelpie fan, so I can see why you use Kelpies, but do they work better than other types of dogs, or is that just, that's just the dog that they happen to use for that?
So we actually have quite a few different breeds in our detection dog program. So we have a Labrador, Labradors, I should say, a lot of Labradors at the moment, German Shorthaired Pointers, Kelpies, Kelpie Crosses, Border Collies, Springer Spaniels. In the past, I've had Cocker Spaniels. And then sometimes, like a lot of crosses, we've had Labrador Cross Pointers, Labrador Cross Border Collies. So a lot of in between. So we really try to look for that sort of hunting gun dog in our pointers. Labradors are pretty much in that category. Your Springers, the Kelpies, we've got our herding dogs in the Border Collies and Kelpies. It's quite fascinating because like Kelpies like to work off lead. They're farm dogs. But we actually have quite a lot of successful Kelpies and Border Collies. So like not all dogs, and that goes for all breeds. There's no particular breed that has a larger percentage of success. I guess it comes down to, like all animals, it really is the individual dog. There's a lot of things we try to, like certain like lines in the dogs. Like you've got your, like Labrador is a good example. We sort of look for that retrieving Labrador that is used more for hunting and stuff like that, versus there's lines of Labrador that are more domesticated, more suitable for a pet style home. So our Labradors are very, very energetic, like very high drive. Instead of our big bear Labradors we see sometimes get around homes. But then you got, your Kelpies and Border Collies. They've got the great drive.
Yeah, I believe historically a lot of dogs are, you know, Labradors or Beagles, those ones that have like the great sense of smell and that kind of thing. But I can see what you said with different merit for different breeds. They would have, you know, different strengths. So a Kelpie or a Border Collie, they're quite eager to please. So I can see how those kind of breeds would be a bit more helpful. So yeah, that's a cool thought. I'm glad that there's a few different types that you're trying out.
I guess the perfect combination is, they say so obviously that high drive, like want to work, a lot of energy that we can tap into, but then certain breeds, and I can't say this loosely because I'm not, this is just from personal experience, certain breeds have their olfactory has, they call it like a parts per billion, parts per trillion, and there's a further one. I just can't remember how far it goes after chewing, to be honest. But you get what I'm saying. Their nose sensitivity across. So that perfect combination of the nose sensitivity and the high drive is what we look for. However, as I've, like, the more I do this and the more dogs I've managed to get my hands on, just because the dog, especially with our pointers, So I love my Kelpie, but a German short hair pointer has been like my just sort of my all time favorite breed. So that is my second dog that I have as well. Their nose sensitivity is, I won't say significantly because I'm not going to make those claims, but you can see their nose sensitivity is higher than, let's say, a Kelpie or Border Collie, but it has been problematic in some of the training situations. So especially in our role where we need them to like really locate certain odors, if it's too sensitive, they may be able to locate it from a distance where we require detail. We may not be able to pinpoint a certain like area in a cell or something we may need to remove it from. We may just get, it's a bit like a pointer. Oh, like it's here. It's in this area. It's this, somewhere in this meter. That's where some of the breeds can have, it's just that fine line of, literally train the dog that's in front of you. Don't always rely on genetics and the breed necessarily.
That's cool. I love that. Now, sorry, I went on a bit of a tangent there by thinking about the different breeds and their strengths, but can you briefly explain what the canine unit role is?
So our canine unit within Corrective Services New South Wales, there's two main streams of dogs that we have. So the one that I am primarily involved with and lead to some degree is the passive alert detection dogs. We call them our PAD dogs. So they are they're tasked with preventing contraband from being introduced to correctional centres and also removing any contraband that may be in the correctional centre. The contraband that they will be trained in is our drugs, our prohibited substances. And we also have what they call a tech dog who looks for phones to remove phones from prisons. So the other stream of dogs is our multi-purpose dog called our MPD dogs. So these dogs are there for protection, for security, for crowd control in the case of a disturbance within a center around the state. They also have the capacity to wind scent and track. So anyone that may have escaped custody. So they're sort of our main functions with the dog unit for corrective services.
Wow. It's so crazy, like hearing all these things. It's so interesting and like the type of work that you do and how amazing and like the assistance that they obviously provide you in completing so many different things within the role that you have.
Yeah, absolutely. Like we really are fortunate, like the things that they can do on both streams. I work very closely with our MPD team, so we are in the same, but just seeing what both functions the dogs serve it's very impressive.
Yeah, absolutely. To like for someone maybe listening to be successful in gaining a role for like the canine unit for correctional services, I know you've mentioned that you obviously gave a lot of your time within the correctional services within slightly different areas, but is there any sort of experience that people might be people might need to particularly gain before trying to get into a role just like yours?
Not necessarily. It is desirable to have worked in correctional centers because it helps you understand, it's good practice to be a correctional officer and get to learn the layouts of the jails and stuff like that. But it's also going to help you be quite a successful dog handler if you know the environments that you're going to have to be working these dogs in and you're going to have to preparing them for these environments. So one of the best, like the main traits I would sort of recommend is there's a high level of fitness which is required. The dogs we work are high drive, and it's not necessarily about being the fittest or the strongest. It's because you have to, like, the training is intense and we have to get as many repetitions into the dogs as possible. If the dogs aren't succeeding in particular sessions, things have to change. You've got to have that sort of energetic personality. You've got to flow with the dog to get the greatest success, which sort of brings me to personally my biggest thing for anyone that would want to work in a canine unit, regardless whether it's corrective services, sort of any working dog capacity, is attitude. And I'll use a quote that I got from Dean, which is actually, it's now on a sign in our unit, is your quality of work is their quality of life. It really resonated with me. And it's so true. Like we're choosing to work with these dogs. They're not choosing us. We need to, you need to show up. You need to give 100% every day. Yeah. Attitude's probably the most valuable thing I feel. If you're going to jump into a working dog space.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know we're going to dive into a little bit later on, but I was just wondering whilst I was listening to you, do you get given the tools and the learning around training and like the use of upper and conditioning going into a role working for the correctional services, or is that something that you've kind of had to develop on your own?
Yeah, so we do. So on our 14-week handler course, so there's a quite a large, about a month of theory component where you do touch on classical conditioning. So the new handlers get to learn like Pavlov, and then they dive in a little bit into operant conditioning, the quadrants, where it stemmed from, its origins. Yeah, they do get, and I was exposed to a bit of a foundational understanding of that stuff. I definitely wanted to understand it a lot more. So I have dove quite deep into our classical conditioning, our operant conditioning, each individual quadrant, where it's necessary, where it's not necessary, even if it's necessary at all. I'm about to run a handler course, in fact, in 3 weeks, and there's a pre-course assignment for my new handlers that are coming on, and it is all about operant and classical conditioning. So
woohoo!
I hope they complete their pre-course assignment. So to a good start, because it's really important, because like I don't know if you've seen the quotes, like especially classical conditioning, it's always at play. Our dogs come home with us, so they live with us. They're with us 24/7. So you really need to know, yeah, especially with classical conditioning, things you may indirectly be doing or teaching or reinforcing around the house. And on the, like, if you walk your dog on your days off, dog parks, there's so many things handlers need to be mindful of to ensure that their detection dogs are maintained at a high level.
Do they have like, are you able to communicate with the dogs when they're at work and when they're not at work? Or is it purely just like the setup of the environment is part of the kind of behavior?
So that could be, that's a really, it's something always constantly in discussion. And I guess the caveat would be the dog in front of you. So every dog's different. But from my experience, my dogs, I think the setting of the like home and backyard, Dusty, for example, he switches off. He's affectionate at home. He's a big lap dog. He's quite large. He's Kelpie cross. I actually don't know what the cross is, but he's quite big for a Kelpie. He's quite lanky. And he's a big lap dog at home. When he's at work, he's antisocial and he just wants to work. Like he doesn't want anyone to pet him. He thinks a pat means he's going to miss out on working. Like he's just so on. And I think through that classical conditioning, the whole, he goes into my work vehicle, like all that to him, that context switches him on. So our dogs rely on a conditioned stimulus. So it's either a harness or a padded collar. So that is utilized before each drug search. So the dog learns essentially, yeah, that means we're about to go to work.
So that's pretty much like the cue to be like, okay, we're working. It's like the presence of the harness or the collar. It's like, okay, here we go.
Yeah. But then there's another angle where we have a fetch command, which starts the search. So there's three different things. So it could be the whole car, work location. So he starts whimpering when I drive onto the complex because he's we're at work.
Mm.
So that turns my dog on. As another dog might be really nice and chill until the harness or the collar comes on. And then we've got a third dog, which might not do anything until they're given their fetch command. And
wow.
So that's why I said, the caveat is the dog in front of you. So
yeah, I mean, it's a bit like all of us. It could be, you know, some of us are really chill and fun on the weekend, and then as soon as we get to work, there's no more laughter, it's on. And then
absolutely
aren't working until we warm up for 20 minutes having a cup of tea. So yeah, those are the tools.
Perfect.
Now getting back into that, so for a canine unit, obviously odor needs to be at the front or the forefront of their mind. Can you chat ways in which you train that?
Yeah, so there's thousands of methods. Like any animal training, there's so many different methods to train certain behaviors. The best way I've learned is there's two schools. They call them two systems, should I say. We've got delayed conditioning and we've got simultaneous conditioning. Now, there's a whole heap of methods which sort of fall into each of those conditionings. Now, I won't, one of my mentors from the US, Cameron Ford, he coined those terms. So I use them, and they're awesome way to sort of bracket these methods. So I guess to give a sort of a very brief breakdown of those two conditioning systems, and then I'll give you some examples. So delayed conditioning is where a dog will come into the odor, so sniff the odor. They will then hear their marker, their bridge, and then they'll receive their reward. Simultaneous conditioning is when the reward and their odor will be paired together. So the dog, we want the dog to have a huge positive association to the target odor. So that's how we achieve a successful detection dog. So when we have delayed conditioning, we sort of create the positive association. Obviously they sniff, they mark reward, sniff, mark reward. The simultaneous conditioning, because their reward is paired with the odor, there's already intrinsic value in the toy and then the target odors in the same vicinity. Perfect example, a Kong. I can put a Kong in one of our detection boxes and I may put some target drugs inside the Kong. The dog will see their favorite reward with the target odor inside. So eventually with simultaneous conditioning, you'll, in the same sort of method as the delayed, they'll come into their toy and you'll, while they're sniffing their toy with the target odor in it, you can then direct reward. So you can throw in another toy, you can feed reward. The dog event, and then eventually the more repetitions the dog does, we slowly fade away their toy. And then eventually, so Kong's a great example because you can fade Kong, we can cut up until we're not supposed to be able to cut Kong. That's the Kong company that's like that.
Yeah.
They're indestructible, but you can fade it right down to really little shavings. And then eventually the Kong is removed. And generally the dog will focus on that. They'll already have that association now with the target odor. So that's simultaneous conditioning sort of system. Our delayed, we keep doing that sniff, mark, pay until the dog show. Once we do that, we'll do that for about, every dog's different, but anywhere from 5 to 10 days. We'll then add two empty vessels. So either a PVC pipe or a detection box is what we like to use. Then we'll let the dog approach the three vessels, and then they'll give a significant change in behavior on the odor that we've just spent quite a few days doing the delayed conditioning on. So once we see that significant change, we know that there's a significant positive association with that target odor. So we can start, that's when we can start to build on that. So the odor will move from left and right and we rotate. And as long as the dog leaves the empty vessels and keeps going and gives a significant change of behavior in the loaded vessel, then that system is off and running. Now with both those systems, they both have pros and cons. Delayed conditioning, one of the biggest pros is it's a very clean, sterile way to introduce a dog to a target odor, because they're essentially sniffing just the target odor, getting marked and rewarded. Now, it doesn't matter, like you can either reward indirect or direct. The dog can come back to you for their food or their toy, or we can mark and deliver the reward to source. The cons of delayed conditioning is it can sort of, from what I've seen in some of the dogs I've done it with, if the dog doesn't have a huge natural hunt drive, like to just hunt areas, I've seen a little bit of flattening. So when we move the dog out into a larger area to sort of encourage them to, they now have this positive association for that odor. Hey, go search for it in a larger area. They struggle to sort of show independence and go out into the area and search. Now that's where I've seen that some dogs are excellent and they just do it. They just will fly out into the area and that's okay. But then some dogs don't. They struggle to show that independence. With simultaneous conditioning, what happens is because the reward is with the target odor, they get a positive, some of the pros, they get a positive association with the target odor quite quickly because they've already got that intrinsic value in the toy being paired with the target odor. So that can accelerate some odor imprinting in our detection dogs. However, sometimes we can see a bit of erraticness. So it depends how frantic, like if dogs love chasing a Kong, if they love like a bit of tug of war, if we've got the Kong on a rope, you can see sort of those behaviors potentially in the odor, like in that picture. But a little bit funny, I had gone through a few dogs where the simultaneous conditioning didn't present any issues until there was a day I was working this very high drive Labrador and she loves her Kong. I don't know why I did this. I just, we're shaping an indication. We're trying to get her to sit on odor. I thought it was a great idea. She didn't need it. She knew the target odor. For whatever reason, I put a little chunk of Kong in with the target odor. I still don't know why. Now, these detection boxes we use, there's a single large hole. So inside the box is just darkness. So that's obviously encourages the dog to use their nose. So I've gone in to conduct this session. The box is angled to encourage the dog to sit. She's gone in, she smelt the target odor, but then all of a sudden she just went crazy and started attacking the detection box like a shark. And then it dawned on me, she thought her Kong, because it was dark, she thought her Kong was sitting in the box. So she just went bananas. So I learned in that moment. So there's a disadvantage of simultaneous in that sense. I guess two quick examples practically that I've used. In delayed conditioning, there's this system called Odor Pays Box, coined by Cameron Ford. I'm not going to steal his words. It's just a box, and in the center of the box, we have the target odor. And what happens is the dog comes in that sort of delayed sense. The dog will sniff around the box, and when they sniff the jar in the center of the box that has the odor, we just drop food over the dog's head. So eventually, the dog learns sniffing that little jar in the middle of the box results in food dropping, therefore odor pays. So they learn that. That's a delayed conditioning. That's a little exercise that we do with some of our dogs. Another example of simultaneous, aside from the Kong, is a more traditional method, which is highly effective, is we'll roll dummies. Dummies are rolled towels. They're a very popular toy with the dogs. We will sit them in a bag of marijuana for about a month, and then we'll play fetch with the dogs. So we're starting to get that positive association quite quickly because the dogs love to chase these dummies. They love to play. They engage with the handler. They get to play tug of war. And then we let them possess it. We let them run around with it. We let them keep it. So we create a huge positive association with that target odor. So there's sort of two ways. We've got our rolled dummies, which has the target odor and the toy in a different way in one. And then our odor pays box where they come into odor and then they get rewarded.
That is so interesting. Yeah. Like, yeah. That's explain that so well. I think like I'm a person when you put it with examples, I'm like, ah, I got you. So I feel like the delayed response, the delay conditioning is like where you're actively seeing the behavior, like you're seeing, and then you're following with the consequence pretty quickly. Whereas the simultaneous conditioning, you might not have full control over what you're reinforcing if the food is already present with the box before the animals even approach. So you're just kind of hoping that they're offering the correct thing. And then my other thing I was going to mention was whether they have different reinforcers like toys. And then you mentioned that. So that's really interesting that you can also, you know, utilize other reinforcers, because I can imagine, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I know a lot of Kelpies, Collies, like are highly reinforced by toys over food a lot of the time. So it's cool that you can utilize the preferences to that breed to still be successful.
You're right with the scented towels. So that is something, a concern, and it's not a method we're using more because we're not sure what we are reinforcing, because there's that hot, there's a particular, like delayed, we know the dog's sniffing the target odor in that method. Even with the Kong method, are they still smelling the Kong? They're not really worried about the target odor. The rolled dummy, are they smelling the rubber band that's holding the dummy together? Is it the towel? Has the pot smell faded? Because there's a whole science, as you can imagine, in detection like a rolled tower might be only good for an hour once it leaves our safe. Then before it's just a tower, like it doesn't really have the odor. There's also when you, it's funny you say with the Kelpies and Border Collies, Dusty will not take food. So I have to do everything with a toy, which is fine because he's a lunatic for the toy. So I leverage that to my advantage to train new behaviors in him. However, there's a new thing that's sort of getting around at the moment from my mentor, Cam Ford. There's a big thing on something called Pavlovian interference. And I'm really starting to see it now in some of our dogs. I recently got a dog from another agency that was primarily food reward. So when I got him, I spent a day doing food reward. He had a very nice focus indication. So this dog, I loved it. When he comes into his target odor, he sits not stares at the source. He's not interested in me. He's not interested in anything else in the area. He just wants to stay focused on the target source, which is the gold sort of standard in our indications for a detection dog. What happened was I decided to play around. So I did a day of that. And then the next day I introduced toy reward to him. Now this is where this Pavlovian interference come in. So this was a dog where I did a heap of food reward. So I got to see a nice solid indication. As soon as I started throwing a ball for him, his drive went through the roof, which was excellent. When he came into the indication, he started looking at me. He started looking at me. He started looking around the room. He still held his sit and he stayed in the vicinity. But it was so fascinating to see once I activated that prey drive in the search area, his body like was tensing up because he knew now, oh, this target odor is going to lead to my favorite toy now, not just food. So that was something really fascinating. And now that I've, once that term got thrown around, Pavlovian interference, I'm now starting to see the dogs that did the Kong, the ones that were successful, they have a little bit of it. They're anticipating a Kong being thrown. So they'll back up. They'll do some other behaviors. And I'm like, this is incredible. Like they're truly using odor. They're indicate, like we look for a sit, we look for a stand, we look for a freeze, we look for a down. They're backing up. It makes sense. They're just getting ready for the fetch game that's about to initiate. That's something only recent that I've really, yeah, got to see it practically, which is awesome.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Now, you mentioned that you would like to consider, you know, the dog that's in front of you and will choose, you know, what type of conditioning you're going to be using depending on who you're working with. Like, what other factors do you consider when you're deciding what to use?
So what we'll generally do, I guess the process when we get a new dog into the unit that's going to be potentially become a detection dog is first and foremost, we charge a marker. Generally a verbal. I sometimes like to use mechanical, like a clicker and a verbal. So once we've got that charged, so we've actually got a communication system with the dog, we then will look at, I'll start to play around with, see what their food drive is like, see what their toy drive is like. We do a little bit of a reward hierarchy session. So if they're an older dog, like over 12, let's say 18 months old, and I know that they've in their life. So if we've received them from a breeder, we've rescued them from a pound or the RSPCA. So we have a room called a shaping room, which is quite sterile. So that's where all our odor imprinting takes place. That probably should have led with that, with the delayed and simultaneous conditioning. So it's very sterile and it's very easy, good for the dog to not have any distractions, stuff like that. So we'll have a pile of toys. So we'll put our rolled towels, a Kong, there's a gape, which is sort of a harder fire hose for those stronger biters. We'll have a sort of a ball on a rope, a foam ball on a rope, and we'll put in a traditional tennis ball and then a tennis ball with a squeaker in it, which is quite a favorite with the dogs. We'll pile them all up and we'll let the dog, we just walk to the front of this shaping room. We'll let the dog go in 3 to 4 times. I have a little form. I keep noting down each time which dog toy the dog takes. So we start to see, first and foremost, how drivey are they for a toy? Like, are they charging into the pile to get one? And then we take note of what toy they're taking. So we let the dog choose their highest valued reinforcer. Then we'll do something a little bit separate. Like, see if the food drive is good, we'll look at, is it their standard kibble? Do we need to use some raw food? Do we use a sort of in between, a bit of freeze dried food? Some dogs love their cheese or Frankfurts. We establish hierarchies in both the food and the toys. So once we've established the hierarchy, once we have their favorite toy, we'll go into certain areas. We've got, like, outside our unit, we've got quite a big gym, we've got a hall, we've got little storerooms, we've got change rooms. We've got quite a lot of areas without having to actually go into a correctional center to sort of test the dog's hunt drive. So if the hunt drive's really good and they have a really nice food drive, we'll sort of lean towards the delayed conditioning method just for that cleaner sort of introduction to odor. At the same time, while delayed conditioning is happening, we will still make sure that the dogs are doing their sort of toy hunting in areas, because eventually they're going to come together. The target odor is going to lead to the reward of their toy, but we'll use food to get the reps. Now, when we have a dog like our Border Collie and Kelpies that don't have a huge food drive, that's when we'll start to look at our simultaneous conditioning. And that's where we've had a lot of success in the history of using our scented dummies. So my boy Dusty was trained on the scented dummy method. Other dogs in the park, like dogs before me and some dogs that are still in my generation of dog handler, excellent detection dogs, and they were trained under that method. There's now, it's only recently that I've played around with the Kong in simultaneous, the Kong with the target odor. And they were used on dogs that didn't have the biggest food drive. They took enough food for it to potentially be used, but not enough to get a nice consistent repetitions in the delayed conditioning system. Probably in a nutshell, food drive will sort of determine which sort of system the dog goes to. And in addition to, toy drive, like the ability to hunt for their toy is pretty key to any of the detection dogs, regardless of what system they get trained in. Because if we have a dog that doesn't really hunt for a toy, it's quite difficult to sort of test them before we go down the whole training path, like getting them to see how they naturally hunt for things of value. So yeah, you can do food hunting. I haven't done enough of it myself to see how successful it is. There is concerns because there's a lot of food in cells and stuff like that. So I know anyone that is a dog trainer, listen to me. I know we can proof our dogs off food in the cells, and there's a lot of really good detection dogs I've seen that have food reward and they won't indulge in food in search areas. So it absolutely can get done. I just haven't dabbled in the proofing massively myself. I've done like proofing in other things with the dogs that they may encounter that we've used in the training scenario, like our gloves, disinfectants, stuff like that, to ensure that the only thing that they're indicating to is our target odors.
Now, just quickly, obviously some species, you know, for example, parrots, their preferences might change all the time. You know, you one day they're doing it for sunflower seed and the next day it's this. Do you have to consistently test what their preferences are, or is that something that you do often or not?
It's funny you say that. So it is something we're actually going to implement, because as I said, like I said to you guys before the recording started, like I'm a massive dog nerd. So I'm always diving into new literature, books, all sorts of stuff. And there was a suggestion that reward hierarchy exercise, some people do it monthly. So, so even with toys, they like to check if that is still your dog's favorite toy.
Yeah.
Same with the food. The food would probably be a bigger thing, because how does the dog feel on any given day? They may not particularly want their kibble that day. They might want the kibble over the raw food. I guess it all depends. Like, we have our some sort of consistency, but yeah, it's definitely something we're going to do to sort of maintain the drive and the consistency in the dogs. And more importantly, we want to give the dogs what they want. They're the ones working for us. Like, so
yeah,
to pay them with their value.
Yeah, that's a cool thought.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love how you spoke about the choice, like allowing the dogs to have the choice and picking their reinforcers, etc. And that kind of leads a little bit onto my next question, because one thing I think we have found in probably historically and definitely moving away from now is that a lot of positive punishment is used for dogs and adversive techniques, etc., which is obviously something that we really have moved away from within zoos and aquariums. Coming into a dog canine role, have you found that the facilities you've worked for have been really open to positive experiences only and the use of kind of only positive ways treating towards dogs, if that makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So especially like in the detection dog world that I've been a part of, anything to do with detection is 100% positive. Like at the end of the day, we need, like, odor has to be the most positive thing in the dog's mind. I have a lot of rules. So with our detection dogs, even amongst myself and fellow trainers, I want nothing in the training shed that can even be remotely promote conflict in the dog. So good example, the dog's done the great training session. They've got their reward. We did have in our mind that we wanted to do more repetitions. The dog's not letting go of the reward. I don't want anyone to try get the toy off the dog in that training shed, because that has to be an incredibly positive space. Address that elsewhere. Go teach the out behavior elsewhere. We can do that through obedience. You can do that with food. You know, dog lets go, yes, reward, food. Like we can train that so there's no conflict ever in detection. When we look at the operant conditioning, I guess in detection, in my experience, the only two sort of quadrants we float around with detection dogs, obviously, first and foremost, is our positive reinforcement. And may, like, from time to time, I will rely on my negative punishment. I have a little crate, which I call my naughty corner. So if the dog's potentially not do that, and this is for dogs that are obviously know the task, they know what to do. They may lose their opportunity for reinforcement. They may go do a timeout in the crate. Or we have our vehicles just outside our training garage. They may lose their chance for reinforcement. So that's been really effective in bringing their mind into the training session so it can be productive and we can achieve those goals. But in saying that, it's, I guess, the times that we've sort of had to resort to that, the dogs, you got to sort of ask, is the dog right for the job? Because it's very rare we have to do that. The dogs, the successful detection dogs, they come in and they love this. They want to do it. They want to do everything they can for that chance of reinforcement. Yeah. In short, I'm fortunate enough to, work in a unit where, positive reinforcement, training behaviors via positive reinforcement is the leading way. To be transparent, we work, obviously our dogs work with the public. So I have to promote our handlers. So we have to keep our dogs under control. So should anything happen, it's one of those things that if the dog's in danger or if another human's in danger, you have to control the dog. We can't really avoid that. But outside of that rare occasion, everything to do with detection is positively based.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's honestly great to hear. Like, it's so reassuring that, you know, techniques are being used to keep it as positive as you can for animals. And I think there's no harm in having procedures in place that if the necessary needs to be necessary to protect animals and the person, then that's okay. Like, we have setups for sure. And I've seen setups with pinnipeds and seals that, you know, it's an absolute last resort, but we can utilize it if it needs to, because at the end of the day, animal safety and guest safety is so apparent, and it needs to be a priority too. So it's just trying to use that and mitigate it and have other alternatives to stop us eventuating to that point.
I guess I sort of talk amongst my team, and if it gets to that point, we've failed somewhere in the training. It's like that old adage, the animal's always right. Like,
100%.
So I'm the one that should be getting punished.
Yeah. I'm always like, okay, that training session was a flop. What did I do wrong? What can I change?
Yeah.
How can I make that better next time? Yeah. It's always a great thing to think about. So one thing I love so much about what you do is that somehow we could be talking about maximum security correctional services, drug detection dogs, and of course we can relate it back to zoos and aquariums, which is amazing. So I know, obviously, we've got to meet you through our good friend Dean, who works at Sydney Zoo, and you have been working alongside their herd of elephants, which is amazing. Yes. So I would love you to share a little bit more information about what you've been getting up to.
Yeah, so I guess I'll start where that relationship sort of started. So I was down at Nowra at one of our sort of dog training companies that we do a lot of training with. He was an ex-police trainer, and he's the one that suggested to me, you should get in touch with the zoos, like how they train. They train the elephants and hyenas, which we're also dabbling in at the moment, stuff like that. So the idea sort of sat in my mind. However, I had a handler there that had gone to Sydney Zoo, and he got talking to Dean, and then they struck up the idea to do a joint cross training. So Dean hosted our whole canine unit, so our training team, a lot of handlers went out to Sydney Zoo. We got to have Dean put on a presentation of how they train, all that stuff, the systems, the methods. And I just remember sitting there going, this is everything we do with the dogs in detection. Like I was just gobsmacked at how similar it is. So at that point, I sort of stayed quiet, and I didn't really say anything. I just took it all in. So after the day at Sydney Zoo, we then invited Sydney Zoo's training team out to our unit, and I did the same thing. I presented to Sydney Zoo trainers how our unit trains our dogs. Then we did a bit of a tour of our canine unit. The trainers got to see one of our MPD dogs take a training bite. That was quite cool. We're going to try to get Dean into a bite suit. That's something to happen later.
Yeah, we would love to see that.
Yeah.
We then worked some of our detection dogs for him. So we got the guys to handle some of our detection dogs, and it was quite fascinating seeing just the natural ability to, like, obviously I gave the criteria of what we're looking for in our detection dogs, the mark, the verbal mark, and the rest was just natural. Like, it's the animal training is just so obviously transportable, I guess. From there is where I mentioned that to Dean. I said, oh, I have a friend that in Perth Zoo had done something with elephants, finding odor, da da da. And then a few days went by, and then, yeah, Dean had reached out and said, do you want to do a bit of the detection elephant sort of project? We started going, myself and the handler that had first engaged with Dean. We started going out to the zoo just once a fortnight. We started doing it in our own time. So there's a lot going on, obviously, leading up to my handler course. So this has come a bit of a hobby outside of work now. So would go there, just do an hour with the elephants. Obviously, as you guys know, the elephants have some behaviors linked to odor already. So they're already on the front foot in that regard. So we just sort of come in with the idea of an elephant. I think the end goal was an elephant to search people in the same sort of nature our detection dogs will, and then an elephant to search I wanted the elephant to search enclosure. I'm really fascinated by dogs that can search an area nicely. So I wanted to see if we can find something that we can hide in the enclosure and the elephant searches the enclosure. Because my dog nerd self started looking at some studies on the elephant olfactory, and it's twice that of a dog's. So this is excellent. We can play around with this. So yeah, we've just been really working on, in the delayed conditioning sense, odor's already positive to Carvey and Ashoka, and they've got a nice indication. I think as an ode to the German Shorthaired Pointers, they've got a bit of a pointer indication. That's coming along nicely. I've had to taper off because of work commitments. I'm still gonna keep going. Like, our relationship's gonna go for as long as I guess we can. Next year is a lot of hopefully new things we might get into. I know the guys there have started the hyenas on the very similar thing. That was quite fascinating. There's a term in detection dogs. What's more important, the odor or the behavior? So a lot of people think behavior because of the indication, but they'll forget that without odor, there's no indication. So I'd come into one of the hyena sessions, and I think they were trying to get the down with the odor, And I just said to Dean, I'm like, look at their stand and freeze is excellent. Like it was better than some of our detection dogs. let's do that. So I believe that's what they've been doing. In terms of like what iBrick can bring back to our dog unit, the biggest thing is the preparing the animals for medical treatment. Like that was the biggest thing I took from it. My boy is Dusty is absolutely terrified of the vet. But I saw like just the way through condition, like positive conditioning, the things they're doing for the animals at the zoo, I thought there's no reason we can't do it for our dogs. We have a really good relationship with our vet. There'd be no issues with us doing some, maybe just going and doing a bit of play in the waiting room, like just little things to create a positive environment, just to at least make them feel a bit better for like going to get medical treatment. And the way Dusty is, I don't want future dogs to sort of feel like that going there. So my puppy who I'm raising, the German Shorthaired Pointer, they're the sort of things I'm already working on. So like at the zoo, handling drills, a lot of positive reinforcement so I can trim her nails because she has claws, getting her to rest her head on my hand, like presenting the head. And because I know Dean's like, prepping for blood draws. And I'm like,
Dean loves the blood draw.
But then I saw the relevance. Like it's just simply that same training method I can use on my dogs to prepare them for nail clipping, to inspect their teeth, to conduct health checks on our dogs that we do each day. I can do it more thoroughly and it's more comfortable for the dogs now. So that's massive in terms of taking back to our canine unit. So the elephant and hyena stuff is absolutely awesome as like a side hobby. It's quite special. Been fortunate enough to sort of see that, because like I never even crossed my mind to reach out to zoo trainers and see how their world looks.
It's like it's such an amazing collaboration that you've been able to do, and probably such a first in the industry as well. And the cooperative care stuff it always blows our mind, and the training programs I have down at Sydney Zoo is fantastic. I remember when I was down there and Dean was chatting about you and your team and what you guys were doing, and I was like, so are we going to be seeing elephants and border security at the airport? Is that what we're talking about? We're transitioning away from dogs. He was like, yeah, maybe not.
That's been the running joke for a bit. So we recently this week hosted a sort of a multi-agency detection seminar, and Dean came along to that, and I believe he got quite a lot out of it in terms of our detection sense. But I think if we're to do it again, I think he wants to bring Carvey in a show car. I just don't know how we're going to do that.
Yeah, how? There's a lot of paperwork for that kind of thing to happen.
Yeah, quite a big trailer.
Now, before we wrap it up, we do have one question from our listener, if we can just jump into that. Yeah. That was, what does the future of your role look like?
I mean, I'll speak a little bit from the future of me as an individual, because it might sort of relate to the detection sort of industry as a whole. I'm really, in the future, I've got a lot of plans. I want to get a lot more science involved in our detection. I'm fortunate enough to have a lot of contacts with a lot of experienced detection trainers here in Australia, from different agencies, from the US, that have a lot of wealth of knowledge through experience. So I sort of want to, like, odor is a chemical. The dog's olfactory is like an organ. So there's a lot of science involved to improve our detection dogs. So I've engaged UTS. So hopefully we're going to get something going around odor, like learn a lot more about odor behaviors. Yeah, there's a lot of science to it. There's certain like temperatures, what temperature does to odor. Wind's a pretty straightforward one, that it moves odor. So I guess moving forward, I want to dive into the science side of it a lot more to get a better understanding, and then use that to change any training methods that may be needed to be changed. And I guess ultimately set the dogs up for the most chance of success. There's learning more about dive more into canine cognition, learning more how their brains work. The future will be a combination of science and a combination of cognition, and then lean on the already experienced trainers that I know in the dog industry that have given me a lot of advice and guidance so far. Just bring them all together.
Sounds like we've got another episode in maybe 12 months.
Yeah.
And all the cool things you're doing.
It'll be a big year. So yeah.
Yeah, so cool. Adam, I cannot thank you enough for joining us today. I feel like this has been so unique for Tess and I, but so interesting and such a fantastic reminder that operant conditioning, positive reinforcement can be used across so many species in so many different situations. Thank you so much for coming on. We are so grateful to have you.
Thank you guys for having me. Yeah, incredibly grateful for being asked to come on.
That was a great chat. I appreciate to everyone listening. It was quite a long conversation, but there was so much to cover. And I feel like there was actually a fair bit that we didn't even cover. I wish we'd kind of spoken a little bit more about using the dogs to be able to sense out phones and technology. Like, so interesting. And it makes sense of how they do it with the different substances, but electrical devices. That's so interesting. So probably a conversation we might have to have again in the future.
Yeah, it was a very interesting chat. We hope that you guys enjoyed it too. We'll be back in your ears next week for another episode of Training Talks and Tales. See you guys.
Bye.